Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What special insight do family lawyers have on the realities of marriage, divorce, child rearing, and personal finance? As my guest today has learned in her 25-year career as a family attorney, some of our society's most taboo discussion topics are almost instantly out in the open when clients talk to their attorneys. And while she typically meets her clients during times of extraordinary stress and conflict, she has come to find deep satisfaction in helping them achieve results that will allow them to rebuild their lives. Margaret Claw is founding partner of the Philadelphia family law firm Berner, Claw & Watson and author of the new book Keeping It Civil, The Case of the Prenup and the Porsche and Other True Accounts from the Files of a Family Lawyer. Margaret, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. I'm delighted to be here.
It strikes me that being a family lawyer is a little bit like being a middle school teacher. When people picture themselves doing the work, they picture the very worst moments of the job and can't imagine there are times when it feels transcendent.
That's a great analogy that I've never heard. And having had middle school age children myself, I think you might be right. Well, I think that lawyers either love or hate the practice of family law. There are not a lot of lawyers who feel neutral about it. It is messy because it is so emotional that you're dealing with people in this, as you said, this very time of crisis, a very raw time for them. But that's also what makes it so compelling, because you form this quick relationship with someone and you really know important things about them. I mean, you're not pushing paper in this kind of a practice. Like, you're dealing with very serious issues, the things that are the most important to all of us, you know, our kids, our relationships. You're tuned in to this deep part of someone's life and you're helping them. And at the same time, the legal issues are fascinating because it's an area of the law that is changing so fast. We're redefining what a family is. You know, in one generation, I mean, it's already changed so much. And so it's a great combination, I think, obviously in the camp of those lawyers who love it, it's a great combination of this sort of compelling, fascinating content and also a really exciting legal field, because the law is changing all the time, and sometimes the culture is pushing the law, and sometimes the law is pushing society, and it's really fascinating to watch.
One of the first lessons you had to learn, Margaret, was the importance of maintaining a professional boundary between yourself and your clients, which, again, I would imagine in the practice of family law is different than any other kind of legal job you can have.
I think it is, and I think that's one of the reasons that so many lawyers don't like it, is because they haven't really tried it enough, or they did try it and they had that problem where they realized that they were too enmeshed with what was going on with the client, and you sort of can't be, or you'll just burn out. And I actually, when I wrote the book, I was thinking about this issue. I've always thought about it, and I wanted to explore it in the book, and I thought back to this case that was the watershed for me, where this happened when I was a young lawyer, about 5 years out of law school. I represented a teenager in a custody case, and she had a baby that was the exact same age as one of my children. I had a 10-month-old baby, and she had a 10-month-old baby, and we ended up, I represented her in a custody case, and she lost custody of the baby, actually to the father's parents. So the judge gave the baby to the grandparents, and she was absolutely beside herself and like fell on the floor crying and outside the courtroom. And I was just, I couldn't recover from this. I went home. It was a Friday. I went home and I spent the weekend just looking at my child and crying and thinking about how, you know, if someone took her away from me. And then I went back in on Monday, and it turned out that the client called me, and she'd gotten back together with her boyfriend, and they were going to get married, and everybody was all happy. and I was stunned, and then I was just furious, like, she ruined my weekend, you know. But I realized then that that was sort of the moment when I said, okay, wait a second, like, her baby is not my baby. Her life is not my life, and I want to care a lot about her. I mean, I do. I always care about my clients, but I got to go home at the end of the day and be with my own family and close the door, because otherwise I would not be still in this kind of practice.
Hmm. How important is chemistry between an attorney and client?
I think in this field, it's very important. I think there are plenty of other areas of law where it wouldn't matter at all. Mm-hmm. You know, you need a lawyer to draft your will. You need a lawyer to do a real estate closing for you. I don't think it makes any difference, really. I mean, it's nice to have someone that you like, but I think in this area of law, you're sharing these very personal things with someone, and you're trusting them to help you with the most important things in your life. And so you really want to feel that they get you and they understand you and they listen to you. And, and sometimes I have a client who I feel like I just don't have that with. Like, I don't relate to them. I mean, mm-hmm. It goes both ways sometimes. And I have had, clients where we just parted ways because it wasn't a good fit for one reason or another.
It's got to be interesting as well, because, I mean, you are representing the client who walks into your office and says, I'd like to engage you for this. You could just as easily, in a parallel universe, be representing the client on the other side of the case. Do you even allow yourself to think about that?
Oh, always. Mm-hmm. I mean, always. And that's part of my job, is to make sure that the person I'm representing understands the position that the other side is taking and why. And I'll often say, hey, if I were representing your wife, I'd be saying the same thing as her lawyer's saying to me. And here's why. Think about this from her perspective as well, because you have to. I mean, that's part of what I think people going through a divorce or having a dispute about their kids tend to be really have sort of blinders on, because they have tunnel vision.
Yeah.
And I think it's really helpful for me to point out to them that there's different ways to look at this. The court's going to look at both sides, not just the way you're telling it to me, and I know how to present your side, client, but you have to understand that it's more complex than that. And I think that also it's not a good service to a client to just be their cheerleader, mm-hmm. and just say, yeah, you're right, I'm going to get that for you. That's not my job. My job is to be realistic with, here's a range of outcomes that are realistic in your case, and to really try to help them put it in the context of the bigger picture.
So you write about, and we'll talk specifically about some of these in a moment, but you've had cases that, parents have very justifiable worries about the custody of their children with the other parent. In other cases, you're having to sort of manage expectations when, something that, like wearing bedroom slippers to school makes a parent crazy, but it's probably not going to be seen by a judge as a sign of abuse, that sort of thing. How do you help someone who is really fixated on something that will not matter much in court?
Well, I try to talk them down.
Uh-huh.
I try to say, look, the fact that, here's a good example, the fact that your wife buys your kids clothes at the thrift store is not going to make the judge think she's a bad mother. It's going to make you look bad to complain about it, because mm-hmm. she doesn't have any money. And you're going to seem like a snob. I mean, I try to explain to them why it's not going to work. And make them see the bigger picture. So even though it bothers you that your kids are wearing used clothes, that, I think it's highly unlikely that a judge is going to hold it against their mom that mm-hmm. she's, that's where she shops. And that's an extreme example of something that I think a lot of us would see as kind of irrational, but sometimes they're more on the edge than that. And I just try to make sure the client understands whether I think it's going to be helpful to them or not. And sometimes I'll absolutely refuse to do something a client wants me to do, as a piece of evidence they want me to introduce, like the thrift store thing. Like, I would just not do that. Or someone wanted me to make a big deal once in a custody case of how she takes the child to church and the father is an atheist. And I was like, I'm not doing that. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not a permissible thing for the court to consider, that it's better for a child to be religious than not. Like, he has two parents, one's religious, one's not. Like, that's end of discussion.
Right.
Because I have a professional reputation to maintain, too. Like, I can't make an argument to a judge that's just completely off the mark. But if it's, you know, if it's a borderline thing, like the slip-on sneakers that my client thought were so inappropriate to wear to school, like I might, if the client felt really strongly about it, I'll say, okay, let's try it. We'll tell the judge about it, and we'll see, you know, what she thinks or what he thinks, because it is that person's case. It's just, so they drive it to an extent, but there's a point at which, you know, I know it's going to turn against them if they push on a particular issue, and so that's why they hire a lawyer, you know, mm-hmm. to tell them those things. They're not going to know, and hopefully they rely on my advice.
So clearly there are cases where, you know, it's a horrible acrimonious moment in the adults' lives, but you know, are confident that the kids are going to be fine regardless. You've dealt with other cases where there is justifiable concern that if the other parent gets custody, that children might in fact be at risk for abuse and things like that. It's not your investment in the case that changes, I guess, but certainly your strategy would have to change in those cases.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest problem in custody cases, the thing that is the most worrisome to me and other family lawyers, is where you have a situation when a child, like, let's say you represent the mother, and there's a case that there's sort of a long portrait of a custody trial in the book that is about this issue, where there's domestic violence, the dad against the mom, and there hasn't been real abuse, physical abuse against the child, but there's the mother, who experienced the way the father treated her, has seen the signs of him treating the children that way.
Right.
And she knows it's a pattern. It's familiar to her, and she's worried that when he has them alone and when they get older and they get more challenging or whatever the triggers are, that they're going to get the same treatment that she got. And, you know, that's very, very hard to sell to a judge because, you know, she has nothing tangible to point to except what he did to her, and that is, I mean, that's relevant testimony, but it's not, it's different, at least in my state, it's treated very differently than if you have evidence of a direct, you know, abuse against the child.
Mm-hmm.
The abuse against the other parent is going to be not necessarily looked at as meaning that parent will be a child abuser as well. And that's a controversial area, very, you know, there's a lot of different schools of thought about what the relationship is between violence against another adult and violence against a child. But, I mean, I tend to, those cases, I tend to have the same gut feeling that my client does, and I'm very nervous about what it will be like for the child when they're alone with that father who wasn't able to control himself enough to keep from, you know, beating my client.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and that, it's really, that's a tough one.
And if the shoe's on the other foot and the other client, the other opposing parent is accusing your client, I mean, how important is it to you to sort of sit down with your client and say, you have to tell me the reality of what took place in your family?
I mean, it's really important. It's really hard to represent someone who doesn't tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I usually, when I meet with a client for the first time, and if there's a custody issue, I always say, tell me all the skeletons in your closet. Tell me all the bad things the other parent could say about you, because I don't want to be surprised. I don't care if they're true. Tell me if they're true. Tell me if they're not true. But tell me what he could say or she could say,
mm-hmm.
because I want to be prepared. I've learned that the hard way. Like, something comes out later and you never heard about, oh, that criminal conviction that, you know,
surprise,
your client has, or
mm-hmm.
the rehab program they were in 2 years ago. You want to make sure you know all that. But there are these intangible things, like that someone knows from living with someone else, and that causes them to fear for their child. And
you know, I'm so sorry, Margaret. Let me jump in. We have to take a quick break. My guest is Margaret Claw, author of the new book, Keeping It Civil, The Case of the Prenup and the Porsche and Other True Accounts from the Files of a Family Lawyer. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses, smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Margaret Claw, founding partner of the Philadelphia family law firm Berner, Claw & Watson, and author of the new book Keeping It Civil, The Case of the Prenup and the Porsche and Other True Accounts from the Files of a Family Lawyer. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Margaret, before the break, you were saying that there are occasionally these sort of intangible things that might allow us, you know, to judge a person on the street, but are not necessarily easily convertible to evidence in a court of law.
That's right. And specifically on the evidence issue, one of the hardest things in custody cases is that frequently what a child tells a parent, unless that child can also tell the judge that, the court is not going to hear that because it's hearsay. Someone that, you know, if someone says something out of court to another person, you can't report it in court. And that holds true, at least in my state, for custody cases. And their evidence rules are different in different states. But so that can be, you know, you can just imagine how frustrating that is. A child, you know, a young child says something to his dad, you know, in a moment of, you know, they're taking a bath or whatever, that's really concerning about the something that happened at the other parent's house. And there's no way to get that evidence in front of the court because the child won't talk to a judge. Hmm. And that's a place where, you know, I understand the reason for that rule very strongly, because think of it from the other side. Think if you could lose custody of your child based on a parent saying, oh, he told me this, you know, mm-hmm. like that. But it's, if you believe your child and the child does say it to you, and you can just feel that the court, the system is not protecting your child. It's very difficult.
There was a time in which many judges assumed children would be better off with their mothers most of the time. Talk about how you've seen that change just over the course of your career.
You know, it's really changed a lot. There is certainly maybe, you know, 20 years ago, it was really, I feel like it was the assumption that moms would have custody of kids and dads would sort of visit with them on the weekends. I mean, that was still the norm. And there has just been a tremendous shift in favor of really shared co-parenting since that time. And now it's become the norm, I would say. And when I say the norm, I'm not sure that's the right use of that term. It's not I wouldn't say it's the most common custody arrangement that people have joint or equally shared custody, but it's what people aspire to, mm-hmm. a lot of people, and it's what courts tend to think, at least where I practice, and I know around the country this is a trend everywhere, as the best arrangement, and not necessarily, you know, 50-50 down the middle, but for both parents to have substantial time, parenting time with children, for both parents to be the day-to-day parent and not just the visiting parent that, you know, lets them stay up late on Saturday night and gets pizza and that's the only time he sees them. You know, mm-hmm. and so that's a really big change. And I find that it's not just dads who really want, you know, joint custody. It's a lot of moms who think it's good for their kids, think it's the right thing, think that their husbands, if it's in the context of a divorce, let's say, even though they don't want to be married to them anymore, they think they're good parents and mm-hmm. they think the kids should be with them both. And, you know, I'll meet with a lot of moms that'll say, you know, he's been a jerk about this or that. I can't stand being married to him anymore, or whatever, you know, in the context of a meeting. And I'll say, well, what about as a parent? What do you want to do about custody? And they'll say, you know, he's a great dad, and I, you know, whatever we can work out is fine. Like I didn't used to hear that.
Yeah.
And that, I think that's really reflects, you know, a cultural change.
How well is the law keeping pace with the growing number of families where there are two moms or two dads or some other what used to be considered a non-traditional arrangement?
Well, I think that's one. That's an area where the law is both like pushing and pulling. Mm-hmm. I mean, like in my state, as in yours, you know, there is no same-sex marriage, and so you have same-sex relationships, you know, and couples raising children, gay and lesbian couples raising children together, who have some legal protections and not others. Like, we have our custody laws and our child support laws are, in my state, acknowledge the role of a non-biological you know, same-sex parent in the household. So those people can get custody, have custody rights, and they can have child support obligations, and but we still don't have marriage. And so, you know, that's it's kind of a patchwork that's all around the country. But I think that is going to play itself out really quickly. I mean, it's just sort of, isn't it incredible how quickly everything's changed? So that's an area that I feel like right now it's very confusing, and it's changing by the minute with the Supreme Court decision on DOMA. And we have this sort of ironic problem in my state, and it, your state as well would have it, where people who same-sex couples who go and get married somewhere else where they can get married, but they come back to where they live, like Texas or Pennsylvania, then they can't get divorced if they break up, because they have to be, you have to be residents of a state to be divorced there. And our state won't recognize your marriage from New York. So we won't divorce you. So you're stuck being married. You can't go to New York and get divorced because you don't live there. You'd have to move there and live there for 6 months. I mean, it's kind of a like the Wild West right now, because there's so many different permutations of the law in different states.
So what are people doing about this, Margaret? If they, let's say a Texas a same-sex couple that's been married in another state, lives here, decides to part ways, are they going to like a mediator and trying to cobble something together on their own that may not be recognized by the law, but at least separates out the things that they built in their marriage?
Yes, I mean, they are. And actually, I mean, people can always contract for anything. So when you say not recognized by the law, same-sex couples, before there was marriage equality at all or even civil unions, I mean, same-sex couples that I represented, we did like dissolution agreements of their domestic partnerships, where we would help, you know, people would, we would negotiate who's going to get what. And those are valid contracts. So they are, there is a legal remedy. It's just that if the laws don't apply to you, the divorce laws don't apply to you, you don't have the same rights that a couple who are married have. And, you know, the hallmark of divorce laws is that it creates an interest in property that's not titled in your name. I mean, that's the basic thing we're talking about when people are married and they get divorced. The laws provide that, you know, you have an interest in your spouse's pension. You have an interest in a savings account that was acquired during the marriage that's in your spouse's name. And you have an obligation for debts that are in your spouse's name if they were acquired during the marriage. You know, that's a basic principle. And so if those are protections for the person, for the economically dependent person, if there is one in the relationship. I mean, if everybody has the same amount in their name, then it doesn't really matter. But if you don't, that's this whole theory behind divorce law, is to that the marriage was a unit, an economic unit, and we're going to treat it that way when they separate and divorce. And so you don't have those protections. You just have title. So it's like the position women were in, you know, centuries ago, not even centuries ago, but the position women were in where they had no, before modern divorce laws, where they were out in the street essentially because they didn't have any claim to what was their husband's property. That's the situation you have now. And I've had some represented some people in gay and lesbian clients in the dissolution of a relationship where they said, I want to do what would I wanted to handle this the same way as if this the marriage laws, the divorce laws applied to us. Mm-hmm. I'm going to pay alimony, for instance. I think it's the right thing to do. I've also had the opposite where, look, if I don't have to do this, if I don't have to share my 401k, I'm not going to. So
I was interested that breadwinner women, you say, respond very differently than breadwinner men when a marriage ends.
Yeah, I think that I have made that observation that men often, I think they're raised with the notion of being a provider and they're comfortable with that. And when they get divorced, they sort of know that their assets and their earnings might have to be shared after divorce. And it doesn't, I mean, this is a complete generalization I'm making, and this does not apply to everybody, of course, but there is a comfort level with that I see in a lot of my male clients, and my women breadwinner clients who, you know, are, when they get divorced, tend to be really upset about the thought of having to pay alimony or even just like sharing retirement benefits that they've earned. And You know, I think a lot of it is that we as women, we don't expect that to be in that role. You know, we didn't think we were going to be the provider for the family, for the whole family, and we kind of feel maybe a little bit cheated by that. I mean, I'm going beyond my lawyer hat here, but I get it. Like, I understand that it's not what you kind of thought you were signing up for, maybe. But it is a gender difference I've noticed, and I always have to remind, you know, women about, like, well, you know, these are laws that were designed to protect women. Mm-hmm. Think about, I talked to them about that, you know, like, this is, these alimony laws are, you know, to protect the person who stayed home and took care of the kids. And, of course, they always say, well, he never took care of the kids. He didn't do anything. He just didn't work. Mm-hmm. I still took care of the kids and brought home the bacon. And, you know, there may be, that may be true in many of these cases.
How has the fact that your clients, I guess, will tell you absolutely every detail of their finances as they're trying to separate and build a separate life for themselves, how has that changed the way you sort of look at everybody, being able to maybe imagine what their financial lives look like that they don't tell even their best friends?
Well, it just made me think about that a lot. I mean, because I deal with people's personal finances on a daily basis, I am completely comfortable talking about money. Like, it just, you know, I think it's like if you're a, you know, if you're a gynecologist, like, you know, it doesn't make you uncomfortable, the idea of doing a pelvic exam. You know, mm-hmm. It doesn't seem like a weird thing. It's what you do all day. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know if that's a good analogy, but, you know, there are things that people think are very private and very uncomfortable, and if you do them all the time, they're not. And I don't think talking about money is uncomfortable, and I would have no problem telling anybody, you know, what I made or what, how much I owed on my credit cards, or, like, I just don't, I'm, you know, used to that information being shared, and I find it very interesting how socially taboo that is, and how, you know, I have all these people I represent. I might have seen somebody twice, and I know more about their finances than I know about my best friend or my sister, you know, and I just find that curious. And I think that maybe one of the reasons that finances are such a point of stress for people in marriages is maybe that's because it's so taboo. Like, I think people are more likely to talk to their friends about, you know, sexual problems in their marriage than they are about money problems in their marriage. Hmm. It's really like our last taboo.
How often do you find that one spouse is clueless about the financial status of the couple?
A lot of times. Mm-hmm. A lot of times someone is clueless, and it's not a gender, it's not like it's all women either. There are definitely men who don't know anything about the family finances. The women, you know, the wife is the one who kind of handles that. And I think it's, and I wrote about this in the book, much to my husband's chagrin. I mentioned that this is something that in my own family, that's the relationship that my husband and I have about our own finances. I handle it all, and he trusts me, and it works out fine.
You're keeping him in the dark. It's that he would rather that you handle the bills.
He's not interested.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He's not interested, and he knows it's something I'm good at. He's not good at, you know, it's like paying bills to him is like a nightmare, mm-hmm. or doing taxes or whatever, and I enjoy taking care of money. So it's kind of like a division of labor, like who does the grocery shopping and who does the laundry. But I think about him sometimes when I'm sitting with a client who can't tell me basic information, like how much you owe in your mortgage, you know, what's in your 401k or your spouse's 401k. Like, he wouldn't know that. I mean, he would know where to go look for it, but he wouldn't know it off the top of his head at all. He wouldn't have any idea. And so it makes me, like, I think about that. It's not, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing if the marriage is working well, mm-hmm. because, you know, like I said, it's a division of labor. But it can be really, you know, if that's paired with a power imbalance, then it's really dangerous, I think, because then one thing that can happen is you can find out that there's all this debt that you didn't know about. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have that kind of marriage where your spouse just doesn't discuss anything with you, and I have people like that, they have no idea. They had no idea about debt until, you know, things were getting repossessed or, you know, creditors were calling the house. They had no idea that their spouse owed all this, you know, borrowed all this money. That's obviously a terrible way to be married, to not discuss with your spouse something that's going to affect them. So I do think it, you know, people need to keep their eyes open.
There was a time when if a child was being adopted, everyone wanted to sort of give the adoptive parents the option to even tell that child if that had happened. And the law is sort of still written that way. Can you talk about how birth certificates are altered when a child is legally adopted?
Yeah, that's something that's always kind of fascinated and appalled me. And I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with adoption and maybe have adopted children or were adopted, and they're going to know this, but I think most other people don't, which is that when you adopt a child, the sort of final thing that happens in the adoption is that a new birth certificate is issued, and it has the name of the adoptive parents on it. So, and people really want that. People are really excited to get that birth certificate. And I mean, I get that. But I find it very bizarre because it's a complete fiction. And it wipes out the identity of the child. You know, that. So, I mean, you weren't the parents, in fact. You are adoptive parents. And there's nothing wrong with that. And I wonder why we don't have another document that's called, you know, an adoption certificate, and why we actually go through this process of falsifying an identity document, which is really what it is. And I mean, it does go back to this idea of adoption being kind of shameful, yeah, almost, and secret, and something that, like you said, maybe even a child wouldn't be told about, and to protect the identity of the birth parents and all this. And I mean, it's a very complicated issue. I don't mean to make light of it at all, because it is, those are still important considerations, but I think that's changing, and there's a big rise in open adoption where the birth parents actually, you know, select an adoptive family or have a relationship with the adoptive parents and then continue to have a relationship with the child after they're adopted. That's becoming much more common, and I think the idea of this secrecy around adoption is one of those things that's, you know, kind of... It's outmoded in a way. It's not really part of contemporary society or contemporary family culture. Mm-hmm. But we still do have this process of you know, issuing these new birth certificates.
My guest is Margaret Claw, founding partner of the Philadelphia law firm Berner Claw and Watson. Her new book is called Keeping It Civil, The Case of the Prenup and the Porsche and Other True Accounts from the Files of a Family Lawyer. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses, smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour to attorney Margaret Claw, author of the new book, Keeping It Civil, The Case of the Prenup and the Porsche and Other True Accounts from the Files of a Family Lawyer. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Margaret, to the extent that they ever find out about it, you say that your clients have a hard time accepting that you might be very close socially with opposing counsel, and yet that doesn't affect the way each of you argues for your own clients' needs.
Yes, and I'm not sure about very close socially, but I certainly, I mean, I have a social professional relationship with a lot of the lawyers that practice family law in my community, and I think that's true everywhere, that lawyers who practice in their area of law are going to know each other, and especially in smaller communities and a city like Philadelphia or Dallas, you know, it's going to be, you're really going to know people. But I know most of the people I'm up against because I've been doing this for a long time. And, yeah, some clients have a very hard time accepting that, you know, I'll be chatting with opposing counsel in the court waiting room about, you know, their kid going to college, and then we'll go into the courtroom, and they're worried that I'm not going to advocate for them vigorously because I know the other lawyer. And they, I think their thought is that I need to dislike the other lawyer just like they maybe dislike their ex.
Right.
And that's, you know, when I say it like that, it's probably obvious, well, that's kind of ridiculous. But that is how people feel. And they, you know, and I get it, because the other lawyer is sort of the, you know, the symbol of, they don't like the other lawyer,
right,
usually, because the other lawyer is saying things that are not what they want to hear, and so they don't want me to like the other lawyer. And but, you know, they're wrong about that in terms of effectiveness as an advocate, because I work, you know, I'm more effective, I think, with an opposing attorney who I know knows the law, I trust what they tell me, I respect them, I can, you know, we can negotiate a settlement well, because I know what that, you know, I can predict how that argument that they're making is going to fly with a judge, and I, you know, it's just that I have a comfort level with their expertise, and it's, I think it, you know, it goes smoother if I know that person, as opposed to some lawyer I've never met, and I really don't know how to gauge if they're bluffing or, you know, what they're telling me. And also, it's just that the practice of law in the litigation context, and, you know, especially in courtroom work, is theater. And I don't mean to make light of it, but it is a role, and we play a role. And the judge puts on a black robe. Mm-hmm. You know, they have a costume. They put it on before they get on the bench, and it's a symbol. Now I am a judge, right? And you call them something. You call them Your Honor. You call them judge. You stand up when you address them. It's all choreographed. And then when that judge leaves the courtroom and she takes her robe off and she hangs it up on the hook in chambers and she goes home and, you know, she goes, takes the bus home and makes dinner for her kids. Like, mm-hmm. It's, and we lawyers also are playing a role, and it's not like a game. It's a serious role,
yeah,
but it's a role. And I have no problem playing that role and being a zealous advocate and then, you know, but being, having a friendly conversation with the other lawyer afterwards or with the judge later who's like reamed me out in court for some argument I'm making. Like, I don't, but I've been doing it a long time. That's actually, I think when you're a new lawyer, it's hard. It's much harder to understand that and get comfortable with that. But more experienced lawyers just easily, you know, navigate that. And I think it is, can be confusing to clients.
How much does the script that you run in cases where you actually go to trial, how much does the script change depending on which judge is assigned to your case?
It definitely changes. You know, the most difficult thing for me is to be in front of a judge I've never been in front of before.
Yeah.
And if that's happening, I call other lawyers who have, and I quiz them about the judge, you know, for something major. If it's just a minor motion that I have to, I'm not worried about it. But if I have like a big trial in front of a judge I don't know, I really want to get the lowdown on the judge. And a lot of lawyers do that, because there are things you know about judges when you've appeared in front of them over and over again that you just, you know, to emphasize a certain, you know, they're going to be amenable to a certain line of reasoning, or you know that they're going to get really upset about this or that and you steer away from that, or you know that they tend to a lot of histrionics in the courtroom, but then it doesn't, don't take it personally. You know, like, mm-hmm. There's just things you know about them. And so I don't think it's really the substance of the case, but it's more just maybe the nuance of how I would present it. And, you know, and then judges have little quirks. Like, I remember there was this one judge that used to be in family court in Philadelphia, and his court officer would tell all the lawyers before you went into the courtroom, do not put your hands in your pocket. Do not put your hands in your pocket, because I don't know what it was, but it really upset this judge. If anybody had their, I mean, it didn't really apply to the women usually,
yeah,
but the men sometimes, you know, in the suit, men will put their hands in their pocket. And it was like this warning, because apparently he just went crazy on guys that were doing that. So the court officer took it upon himself to warn everybody.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Leanne in Denton. Hi, Leanne.
Hi, I'm a family therapist, and I often work with divorcing couples, unfortunately. And I have found that often when the wife is planning the divorce and wants a divorce, even though they were amenable initially to sharing custody and visiting and so on and so forth, the husband will do a complete 180 and get angry and say, I'm going to get the kids away from you. I'm going to take the kids away from you. I'm going to give you a hard time. I'm going to make sure that judge knows that you're not a good mother. So how do the opposing attorneys deal with that?
I think that, and it's a good question, and I think it definitely happens that this is sort of the bigger issue is people who are angry about getting divorced who decide they're going to use custody as sort of the button to push to get back at the other person, right? I mean, that's, you know, because they know that's really going to, you're kind of get somebody where they live, you know, that's the most important thing to your spouse, so I'm going to fight you about custody, even though it may not be really what they want. I think lawyers really know, I mean, lawyers are so familiar with that, and, you know, if I can tell in 10 minutes, like, if I'm interviewing someone with why do they want the particular custody arrangement they want, you know, if they tell me, well, you know, I come home every day from work at 9:30 and I travel for business 2 weeks out of the month and I want joint custody because I don't want her to have the kids living with her, I'm going to tell that client, that's ridiculous, you're not going to get it, and, you know, get off that idea because it's about what's best for your kids. You're not home. So, I mean, you know, so you can kind of tell what people's motivation is by whether they've really thought out the logistics of the situation that they say they want. And a lot of custody arrangements are, it's a lot more mundane than I think a lot of people know. I mean, the judges are really interested in people's work schedules. People's availability is a lot of what it's about. I mean, you know, unless you have a serious issue like violence or substance abuse or something like that, if you have, you know, decent parents on both sides, they really want to know who's available and who's, you know, capable of taking care of the kids at different times during the week. So that's a big issue that I think people sometimes overlook in the heat of the moment. They're just, I'm going to get those kids half the time, and, you know, it's not realistic.
I was surprised to read that sometimes, you know, dividing up the actual, like, financial assets, like the money itself, can be easier than deciding who gets the collection of, like, souvenir spoons that have been in the house for 20 years.
Yeah, that is, I mean, that's something that drives lawyers crazy, and the judges won't even touch that. You know, it's just so, it's impossible for anybody else to decide. Like, how are you going to decide who gets these things that don't have any monetary value, and yet they can be really important to people because, you know, your things have meaning that you've collected during your life, and, you know, and sometimes, you know, there's just, you just have to make a list and alternate picks down the list or something like that. But I think I am not alone in saying to my clients, like, I don't do furniture. Please figure it out yourselves. Because I have no way to negotiate for you. I can negotiate with opposing counsel about the brokerage account and the 401k, and we can figure out what's the best way to divide those things. I cannot negotiate about the spoon collection because, you know, unless it has a value, and then we're talking about something that we can offset, you know, with something else of value. But if we're talking about non-monetary value, there's just no way for lawyers, there's no role for lawyers in that, really, yeah, because we don't know, and we don't know what to say about it, except my client really wants it, you know.
We have an email here from Jay in Plano who writes, mediation is almost a given in family law due to current docket congestion. Are you a proponent, and do you find it a benefit to your clients?
Well, it's interesting. So mediation is, there's two different kinds of mediation that are happening now. There's private mediation where people just go and hire a mediator to help them with their divorce or their custody case. And there's also court mediation programs, and I think that's what Jay is probably referring to when he says because of dockets being so crowded, a lot of courts around the country are instituting, like, mandatory mediation programs. And, I mean, there are some problems with mediation that's mandated if there aren't exceptions, because there's some cases that really aren't appropriate for mediation, like where there's been domestic violence and one person is scared of the other. It's really not a good person to sit in a room, and there's no level playing field there,
right?
You know, and so you have, that's a big issue to make sure that those cases are kind of screened out of mediation. But mediation in general, I think, is a great, on principle, it's a great technique. It gives people control over their own situation. A mediator is not someone who makes a decision for you. A mediator is a facilitator to help you reach an agreement. So, like, we do mediation in my law firm, where some of us are trained as mediators, and it's, you know, it's a very, like, dignified way to get divorced or to work out custody arrangements, because you're just deciding the things yourself. And if you could just sit down at your kitchen table without anybody else there and figure it out, that would be even better. But a lot of people can't do that, but they still want to do it themselves, as opposed to having, you know, a stranger make decisions for them. So they use the forum of mediation is it's kind of a structure, and you have this person who's knowledgeable about the law, who can give you information, who can guide your conversation, can make suggestions for you about what might work and what might not. And that is, you know, it's a great process. I love it, and I think it's the way of the future, as long as people don't get railroaded into it through, like, a court system that says everybody's got to do mediation before you get to see a judge, because there are some people who will just give up everything in mediation because they're afraid.
Hmm.
And that's not, you know, that's what a court can do. That courts protect those people, or they should, and mediation is just gives the opportunity for the person who's dominant to just dominate, and that's not a good.
I hope you won't mind my asking, because you refer to this a bit in the book. Can you talk about how your work with families that are in really dire straits has affected the way you relate to your own husband?
Yes. I have this theory that I wrote about in the book about that there's a lot of family lawyers who seem to have very good long-term marriages, and I've been married for 32 years. I'm in that category. And I wonder if it has something to do with the fact that we see we see the cataclysm that divorce can be, and we really appreciate more than most people do kind of what we have if our families are not going through that, and you know, we maybe don't sweat the small stuff, and that. I certainly think I'm way more tolerant as a spouse than I might have been when I first got married. And, you know, I guess everybody that's in a long-term marriage would say that. But I think it's certainly enhanced by the unhappiness that I see that divorce causes, and the reasons sometimes that people are getting divorced, which sometimes seem to me like they're not that severe.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not my job, right? I mean, to say, like, why are you getting divorced? I mean, people want to tell me, and some people don't want to tell me, and that's fine either way. But sometimes I think people just don't even try.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I really, it's kind of ironic, but I just feel that, I mean, both my partners, if we've been married, the three of us, for, you know, a very long time, all of us, and so many of the other lawyers that I know in this field have, you know, 20, 30, 40-year marriages, which is very interesting. I don't know that many family lawyers that are divorced. Very few.
That would be an interesting next project. Is a divorce lawyer explains how to stay married happily for decades. I would read that.
Well, you know what's funny is I wrote a blog about this subject called Hopeless Romantics, about divorce lawyers being hopeless romantics. And I write for Huffington Post, and Huffington Post ran it. And I have never gotten, like, the hate mail, the comments, was so vitriolic about that. I mean, I just thought it was kind of funny. It was supposed to be, you know, sort of tongue-in-cheek. But that, you know, people really hate divorce lawyers. Like, there are these people out there that have just had, you know, terrible experiences, and they just feel like divorce lawyers are, I don't know, you know, these sort of bottom feeders or whatever. And that post drew, like, hundreds of vicious comments about divorce lawyers. So that was kind of shocking to me.
Margaret Clause's new book is called Keeping It Civil, The Case of the Prenup and the Porsche and Other True Accounts from the Files of a Family Lawyer. Margaret, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Christine McConnell produces our podcast. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.